The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. My name is Morris Williams, and it's my privilege to welcome you to the Free Library of Philadelphia for another wonderful evening of conversation and enlightenment. I encourage you to turn off all your cell phones and other items that might create a noise or distraction. No flash photography. I urge you to buy Elaine Pagel's book, Why Religion, A Personal Story, and join her for a book signing upstairs after the talk and conversation. You have information about Dr. Pagels in your program. I would mention that she is a professor of religion at Princeton, so all of you Princeton grads can have that tie of identity with her. But given the fact that her book really is, an incredible intersection of her lifelong career of wrestling and teaching about religion, and her own personal story, which we're delighted to have Tracy Matuszak tonight, who will interview Dr. Pagels. I wanted to just share a personal perspective. I had a favorite professor who happened to be a religion professor, who taught religious ideas and world literature. And his philosophy was that everyone is religious, because he defined religion as being the primary motivating force in your life. So for Christians, it's trying to follow the teachings of Jesus. But for others, it's the quest for power is a primary motivating force in their life. For others, it's the quest for money. For others, it's a quest of self-gratification. So as you think about and listen to the conversation that will take place here in a few minutes, I encourage you to think about what are your primary motivating forces, motivating force in your life. So ladies and gentlemen, let's give a wonderful Philadelphia welcome to Elaine Pagels and Tracy Matuszak.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out to hear from Dr. Pagels tonight. We will be discussing, of course, her new book, Why Religion, and we'll do that for maybe a half an hour or so, but we've budgeted time for your questions as well, so I'd encourage you to jot down your thoughts as you listen to our conversation, and we'll make some time for your questions as soon as we're finished. So with that said, Dr. Pagels, welcome back
Thank
to Philadelphia.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be here again.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you. So I mentioned that the book is titled Why Religion, and the events that you write about in this book, primarily the death of your young son and then your husband a year later, took place some 30 years ago now. Why did now feel like a good time to write this book?
Well, I'm not sure I felt there was a good time to write it, but I felt there was a necessary time, and I never thought I would. I mean, at the time, those events were like a black hole in space. I just couldn't imagine going back there. But at the, you know, when you deal with trauma, the brain protects you from it by sort of shutting down in some ways. And then it was necessary, but much later, I mean, this is, 25 years later, I thought, you know, you don't live your full life if you don't go back to the things that you've actually experienced and allow them to emerge and be part of the whole fabric. So they just came up after my children were out of the house and I had more time and I'm still teaching. I just found I needed to write. But it isn't just about that. I mean, the book is about why I love the work I do. It's about questions I've been asking myself since I first encountered the power of certain religious traditions, and was surprised by them. So So it weaves those into part of the storyline.
So speaking of questions, the title itself is a question, why religion? What is the larger question that you wanted to answer with this book?
Well, I was brought up in a family of scientists, and my father, as soon as he encountered Darwin, I think it was, he was about 17, he just dropped the kind of ferocious Presbyterianism of his family and said, well, anybody who knows anything about science will have nothing to do with those silly old folktales anymore. So I was brought up to think that religion was essentially obsolete. And anyway, it was a kind of snobbish view that it was really for people who just aren't educated. So I love poetry and dance and music. But at a certain point, I was sort of taken aback by a religious experience that I didn't expect and that my parents were horrified by.
Well, tell us about that, because you write about going to a Billy Graham crusade as a teenager.
Well, that was the shock. Yes, for all of us. I mean, I was growing up in a very, I thought it was the most boring town in the world. A friend of mine said it was like growing up inside of a giant marshmallow.
And this was Palo Alto.
Palo Alto. I mean, it was basically, you know, the suburban lawns and very quiet and very homogenous. No issues visible about anything, you know, any sharp edges, race, crime, you know, various things were just sort of either not present or just blotted out in a certain way by the marshmallow temperature, the whole thing. So when a friend of mine said, well, we're going to San Francisco this afternoon, I just leaped at the chance. Anything going on in San Francisco would be better than that. So I didn't know they were going to this huge thing at the Candlestick Park, which is it was the baseball park, right? Mm-hmm. And there were 18,000 people packed into the Candlestick Park, where I'd seen Willie Mays, you know, play baseball. And there were 6,000 in the parking lot to see this man called Billy Graham. I didn't know what I was getting into. But I was amazed by what happened. He spoke about the United States in a way that nobody I knew ever did. I mean, first he talked about the failings of the United States. I grew up in a very patriotic family. You know, my mother's family were Dutch immigrants. My father's family were Swiss immigrants. And this was the best country in the world, and it's the gold standard for world morality. And science is the world's greatest wisdom. That's what I learned. And he was saying, wait a minute. This nation has now dropped bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, killing over 100,000 people or more, and driving its most brilliant sons, and certainly not then its daughters, into creating even bigger nuclear weapons. And I thought, oh, that's true. And he talked about slavery and segregation being justified by the Bible, and I had never thought about that stuff. So it was kind of startling, and it sort of woke me up to some things that I hadn't thought about. And then there was this huge emotional power of an enormous choir. And then this preacher, who was a very fiery, good-looking 35-year-old preacher, something like that, said you could be born again and have a new life and a new world and a new family and just break out of your life completely. And I just thought that was irresistible. I mean, I was 14, yeah. Right? Going on just 15. Yeah. Who wouldn't?
Sure.
So I just went down and I got born again. It was great. And until I went home. My parents were so horrified and angry, you know, like, this is crazy stuff.
So they wondered, what were you thinking?
Yes, well, yeah. They might.
Yeah.
And so I joined an evangelical church in Palo Alto, and I was deeply involved in it for about a year, and then I wasn't. Yeah. But that was a powerful encounter.
Well, so you mentioned that you were deeply involved, and then you were not. And there was an event that took place that you write about. There was a car accident involving a very close friend, several friends of yours. Can you walk us through what happened that led you to change your mind?
Yes, well, it was, besides the evangelicals, I had other friends who were kind of mavericks. They were poets and artists and musicians and kind of a wild bunch of great people. And one night they were coming back late from a a party up at Ken Kesey's house. He had a house up in the woods there. And, you know, there were rows of motorcycles from Hell's Angels. I mean, we were sort of playing games. I was in high school. We didn't know what we were doing. But it was just sort of an interesting scene, you know? And they were coming back from that, and there was an automobile accident. They were going 100 miles an hour. And and my friend Paul, who was 16 years old, died in the accident. And others were thrown out and nearly killed. I just got a letter from one of them yesterday, from Alan Trist, who was the business manager of the Grateful Dead for many years. And Jerry Garcia was in that accident, too. In fact, years later, yeah.
Well, I have to stop you right there. Because
that's what happened.
Oh. Because I think most people would read your book and read that account and say, wait, what? You knew Jerry Garcia? The Jerry Garcia?
Well, he was hanging out there. And we were high school kids who were sort of just traveling in this kind of group that had a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah.
And he was an amazing musician. It was quite interesting.
And so he was in this car accident.
He was. And later, well, anyway, you asked about the church. So I went back to the evangelical church, and my friend said, oh, that's terrible. Was he born again? And I said, well, no, he was Jewish. Mm-hmm. And they said, well, then he's in hell. Mm-hmm. And I said, what? That has nothing to do with what attracted me to any of that stuff. So I just was devastated, and I walked out alone and said, and I never went back. Yeah. It had nothing to do with it after that.
One follow-up, and I'm wondering, is there a connection between the name, the Grateful Dead, and the accident?
Oh, yes. Yes, I assumed there was. I always knew there was, felt there was. Yeah. And years later, somebody sent me something from a biography of Jerry Garcia that confirmed that.
Wow.
It just had to be. Yesterday, I got a letter from Alan Trist, who was in that accident with Jerry, and you know, it was wonderful to hear from him. I haven't heard from him in a long, long time. Yeah.
So at that point, you walked away from that church. You said you never went back.
No.
And yet, you ended up studying religion as your life's work. How did you come to make that decision?
Well, you know, I wanted to be a dancer professionally. I was doing, you know, improvisational modern dance, and I didn't know much about it. I mean, growing up in California, it's pretty provincial, so all I knew was the Martha Graham school. So I went to study, you know, dance in New York, and it was wonderful. But I found out that the terrible fact was I was pretty good, but that's nowhere in New York. You know, mm-hmm. I thought I'd be waiting on tables forever. And you know, I wasn't good enough. Some of them were really, really good. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, okay, I've got to find a plan B. And that was years later. And I thought about a lot of things that I'd love to explore. But some of the questions were, what sort of hit me in that encounter with that evangelical group? I mean, was it Christianity? Could it be any religion? It had opened up the imagination in ways I had no idea about. It sort of opened up my world. The way I write about this, the way the Wizard of Oz had when I was about 8, you know, when you can live in a much bigger universe and out there with Dorothy and Toto and the Tin Man and this, you know, all of that. And this Christian story sort of opened up the world in a very different way. I mean, not so different, actually.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to find out what really happened back there. How did Christianity become like that? What happened to it? I mean, was there really a Jesus of Nazareth? And what kind of person would he have been? And what do we know about that? Yeah. So I decided to go to graduate school, a secular school where I wasn't going to be brainwashed. Mm-hmm. And so I did that and discovered that there were these secret gospels I'd never heard of. Mm-hmm. So that was huge fun. I mean, we suddenly had all kinds of secret gospels that the church had banned, you know, nearly 2,000 years ago. And I just love the discovery of those secret texts.
Yeah. So you mentioned graduate school just a moment ago, and you talk in the book about how you first met your husband, I believe that you were a freshman and he was in graduate school, and then by the time you were in graduate school, the two of you married. What was it that drew you to Heinz?
Oh, well, he was fabulous looking. I mean, I actually saw him when I was in high school. We were at this little coffee house, my girlfriend and I, and he walked in, and I said, "Do you see that beautiful young boy?" And Dino knows what I mean, his colleague. And so, yes, I didn't meet him then. I was in high school at the time. But when I was a freshman, he was at the university starting graduate school in physics. And we had a lot of mutual friends. And he was just an extraordinary person. He was a great dancer. He was interested and curious about everything. He was a lot of fun. And just marvelous.
Yeah. So after a long struggle with infertility, you and Heinz were blessed with your son, Mark, but it became clear pretty quickly that Mark was facing health challenges. What was going on with him?
Well, he was born with a hole in his heart, and they said, well, this is serious, but we can repair it. So on his first birthday, they did open heart surgery at Columbia Presbyterian very successfully, and it was fine, we thought. And then we were about to resume our life again and go back to Colorado, where we always went for summer. Mm-hmm. And they did a cardiac catheterization and came back and said, we don't believe this, but he's got this disease called pulmonary hypertension. And all I heard were the words, invariably fatal. Mm-hmm. And Mark was then two. And they said, well, and I said, well, how much time? And they said, a few months to a few years. So that's what we were living with for that time.
Yeah. And I wonder how you coped with that, not just emotionally, but spiritually, with that diagnosis for your toddler son.
I don't know how to answer that. Yeah. Tried to live every day, and we had a joyful time, the three of us. And I also kept thinking, exploring, feeling. I was writing a book called Adam, Eve, and the Serpent, which is about sexuality and politics. But the last part of that book is about, it's called The Nature of Nature. Mm. And it's a real indictment of some of the Christian views about nature, which are that, you know, illness and death are punishment for sin, because I thought, that doesn't make any sense to me. And so the last chapter of that is a repudiation of St. Augustine's view. So I was struggling with a lot of issues and questions, because, you know, when you're dealing with something like that, you keep thinking, how do you cope with it? I mean, how do you deal with the turmoil of feelings? And there were all kinds of those, yes.
So you mentioned punishment, and Mark died when he was six and a half.
Yes.
A year later, Heinz died in a mountain climbing accident.
Yes.
And you mention in the book that so often when we face tragedy, we do feel as if perhaps we're being punished for something. Did you feel that way, and where does that come from?
Well, it didn't make sense to me. I don't think that way, you know? But I was reading an anthropologist who said suffering feels like punishment. I mean, you know, when people get struck by lightning or something, they often take it as some kind of a sign. Certainly in the ancient world, they would have. Mm-hmm. And so, and also I had read psychologists talking about when something is wrong with a child, when their child has an illness, a difficulty or a disability of any kind, the mother feels like it's her fault.
Yeah.
The father does not. It's maybe because, you know, we women give birth. So women do feel that way, even if it's not.
Yeah.
And it's just some, you know, weird fluke in nature.
Yeah.
So how do you deal with that?
Yeah.
I mean, when anybody dies, you can feel guilty about it, right? People often do, oh, I wish I'd done more, and if only I'd, you know, all of that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of natural, but a child, you see. I mean, your primary responsibility as a parent is to, you know, keep your child alive and well.
Yeah.
And we couldn't do that. And that was devastating. And without my wonderful husband, it was almost unbearable. Yes.
You talk about several spiritual experiences that you had around that time in the book. And one of them happened on the day that Mark died. Would you be willing to take us back to that day and talk about what you experienced or what you were sensing around the time that all of that was playing out?
Well, I'd rather leave that to the words that I put in the book. It took me 7 years to write a really short book because finding the words for something like that is very difficult. It's just that, you know, writing about some kind of what you're going to call a spiritual experience, I call them experiences I can't explain, can really be a weird thing. And people can, you know, whoa, person's off the deep end. It's not that, but many people have experiences they can't explain. I was having lunch with a friend who's a poet when I was writing this book. And I asked her how she wrote a poem that I really like. It's called Annunciation. Her name is Marie Howe. She's a fine poet. And the poem Annunciation is about the angel Gabriel appearing to Mary and as a sense of overpowering love. And she has a sense of a presence. And I said, Marie, how did you write that poem? And she said, oh, well, you know, it happened to me. But of course, I couldn't say that. And I said, well, why not? She said, that's the last taboo. And I thought, oh, really? Okay, I'm going to write about those things. Because I think that's kind of interesting. I don't know what to make of them. You know?
Yeah. But and it is a beautiful account. So when you read the book, you'll look for that and some of the other experiences that you talk about. You write that after Mark's death, you said, and I'm quoting here, "Meanwhile, the work I'd chosen felt like a kind of yoga, a practice of focus and discovery that can show how countless people throughout the ages contend with questions of meaning, perhaps even a way of spinning straw into gold like Rumpelstiltskin." And I wonder how you and Hines were able to do that, to, as you say in the book, to create meaning as a result of this experience.
Yeah, it's not an intellectual activity, you know that. I mean, we struggled as anyone would. But, you know, and people sometimes, you know, people say, most people here have had the experience of having somebody say something really stupid to you, you know. I remember when the police came to the door after the accident and, you know, to tell me that my husband had died. And the policeman said, God never gives us more than we can handle. Mm. And I thought, how do you know what I can handle? Do you know that our son died a year? Yeah. I couldn't speak, so I just took the door and ripped it off its handles. Now, I don't know how I did it, but that happened. So...
Well, you also share about something that
else... And people sort of think that, oh, you can find some deep spiritual lesson or some nonsense like that. When I say nonsense, I mean my child's life wasn't worth any spiritual lesson to me. So a lot of that sentimental, pious comment just didn't work. Mm-hmm. But, so we could not find meaning in the, you know, a six-year-old child having a very rare illness. I don't find meaning. Cells break down. That's about as far as you can get, as far as I could get scientifically. But there are people who create meaning. And I mean by that, you know, mothers against drunk drivers, you know. If someone loses a child to a drunk driver, they will try to prevent other people from going through an excruciating experience. Or the people who deal with gun control, like those Parkland high school students, after the devastating shock that they all experienced. And that's much worse, you know, dealing with violence. I never dealt with violence like that. But dealing with violence, those children, I want to say, those, 12-year-olds, 13-year-olds, speaking and trying to change the world so that it doesn't tolerate gun violence. So that's what I mean by creating meaning. Yeah. So I think that's what what some of us have to do. And we were so devastated, you know, that I thought I couldn't go on. And then I went to a really wonderful empathetic psychiatrist that Mark's godfather suggested. He's a psychiatrist. Really wonderful. And I said, well, why don't you think of your students as your children? And I thought, I'm not that crazy. It wouldn't be good for them or me. So I just felt that we had to find children who needed parents as much as we needed children. So we did. We found two children whose mothers, birth mothers, were 16-year-old high school students. This is at an orphanage in Texas. And we adopted two children. And that seemed meaningful, to give what we couldn't give to Mark to children who needed it.
And those children are adults now.
They are adults, thank goodness.
I wonder also, where did you turn spiritually during that time? Not only after Mark's death, but then a year later, when the unimaginable happens and your husband died, did you turn to some of these ancient texts for comfort? Did you pray spiritually? What did you do to find healing and to find comfort?
Not much. I mean, spiritual stuff seemed very remote at that time. But there were friends, and there were children I had to take care of and, you know, get to school every morning and all of that. You know?
Because you still had your two younger ones. When Heinz died, you already had the two younger ones?
No, we had
one of them, and
we
then
adopted
the other one.
Okay. So, what did I do then? It's hard to remember. That is like a black hole.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot that was kind of anesthetized. But when I could start to process things again, I mean, there were monks at the monastery. I mean, I'm not Catholic, and I couldn't be part of that tradition because it's so different from what I'm more familiar with. But there were monks at the monastery of St. Benedict in Colorado. They're Trappists, and they don't talk much, and they don't say stupid things. They're silent, they pray, they work. And I known them through a friend of ours, Robert Mann, who said he had been invited to become their first Jewish monk because he played music for them, and he became a friend of theirs. So he took my husband and me up to the monastery when they were playing Beethoven and Bach for the monks. And I got to know them, and they helped me meditate. They taught me how to meditate. And they taught me something about silence. And that was helpful in a way that words wouldn't have been. And years later, when my brain started to come back and reassemble, I went to the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, which it's a scholarly institution, but it felt like a private sanitarium, you know, my own mental hospital at that point. And I decided, somebody had said after Heinz's death, minister at the funeral had promised to say nothing. It was just going to be very simple, and people spoke, and Seth played the flute. That was all. But then the minister got up and thought he had to say something, so he told the people there not to be angry at God. And almost everybody there was in the physics community. They'd never been in a church, and nobody was angry at God. I mean, the idea was just weird, and I wasn't angry at God, but I was really angry at that minister. And he saw that after a minute. He stopped before I jumped up and grabbed
him. Away.
But anyway, but I was angry, you know, because I was so in agony.
Yeah.
And my temper would just fly off really easily. And I thought, well, in the ancient world, nobody would talk about being angry at God. They'd talk about Satan as the one who does stuff like this. Satan is the evil one. He throws obstacles at people. That's how he gets his name. So and Satan seemed to me like a cartoon figure. You know, I mean, I didn't think there was a Satan. I don't think that now. Not literally, certainly. But I thought, okay, how did people start writing stories about Satan as some kind of nasty character who throws obstacles in people's way and does harm? Because that's the role, you know? So I started to study stories about Satan. I thought it would be interesting. And I began to write about the stories about Satan. And then I discovered that some of them are really embedded in the New Testament, which was very familiar to me. And they were even in the story about the life and death of Jesus. Mm-hmm. And then I was really stunned because I was looking at these sort of what I thought of as fantasy stories, right? I have a colleague at Columbia, Peter Ahn, who'd written a book about Satan in Sufi tradition. And we had talked about that. They're kind of fascinating stories. But then that work lasted several years, working on a book called The Origin of Satan, suddenly, to my total surprise, landed me in the real world, where I didn't expect to be again, with those stories. Because I discovered that these stories were used to create what would become Christian anti-Semitism. Mm. And I was shocked, because I hadn't seen it coming. Because in Christian tradition, it's there, but it's deeply kind of buried in the story. So Kierkegaard said an unconscious relationship is more powerful than a conscious one. Mm. And this is unconscious often in Christian tradition, but it's there. And you can see it in the art, you can see it in the history of Western Europe, for example, and the history of America. So that was a real shock. But you ask how I got through it. That work helped, because it was a point of focus. Yeah. And the children and friends, yeah. You know.
Well, I have time for one more question from me before we go to our audience. So I will, to paraphrase Solomon, ask what you think is the conclusion of the matter. That is to say, the book is called Why Religion? Why religion? What is the answer to that? And are you satisfied with the answer you came up with?
Well, I wouldn't say there's an answer to that. If there were, I wouldn't write a book about it. There are many ways. I mean, you can talk psychologically, sociologically, anthropologically, so many ways. And I want to say, you know, I'm not an advocate for religion. I don't like it all. I mean, there's a lot about these traditions we call religion, and, you know, not just beliefs, but prayers and hymns and songs and rituals that go back thousands of years, whether you're talking about Judaism or Islam or Hinduism or Buddhism. There are many things in there that can harm people. You know, like people with sexual lives that are deviant by the standards of, say, the Hebrew Bible. So these traditions can be harmful. What they do is they carry the cultural values of a people. And we sometimes have to say no to them, you know, and disagree with them and leave them behind because, you know, they just don't fit. They don't work. In some cases. I do find for myself that I also engage them. But the study of religion is not just because you think it's all wonderful. It's because you think it's a significant part of the culture. And I really do. I'm teaching a course now about that, about how the cultural messages about what it means to be human and how we as humans relate to what we call nature, or animals, the planet, each other, how we deal with sexuality and politics and you know, human relatedness and all of those things. So it's fascinating to do this work, and I really love it for that.
Well, it is indeed, and we thank you for the work that you have done and are doing. And on that note, let me open it up for your questions and comments for our guest. We've got some staff members with microphones, so just raise your hand. I see there's a hand in the center toward the back there. Yes, sir.
Thank you. You mentioned ethics. Do you think religion gives people ethics, or do you think people give religion ethics?
I don't know how to answer that. I mean, how would we know? How could we tell? I take it that these are traditions that human beings invent. So,
in terms of evolving ethics over time, it seems that people drag their religions with them rather than the other way around.
Well, I think the ethical attitudes in many of these traditions are conservative and quite old, shall we say, right? Because they are traditional and they are ancient. I mean, you see this attitudes about women in some traditions. Well, Christianity and Islam, for example. You see it in attitudes about sexuality and politics, and also our relation to the natural world. So I think your point is an important one. Yes, thank you.
What is your view of life after death?
Well, I wish I had one. I always assumed, growing up the way I did, that it was what Steve Jobs used to say when he said, lights out, you know. I just assumed that that's, you know, the molecules dissolve and dissociate and the person is gone. And I don't know. I did have experiences that that suggested something very different, but I don't know what to think about it. I have hopes. I'd love to see those two again. I adored them both. So I hope I will, but I'm not exactly expecting it, just hoping. So I can't answer that one. Do you?
Well, my answer.
You said that you started studying the origins of the devil stories. Where did it come from, or how does it begin?
I found out that, well, in the Hebrew Bible, there really isn't a Satan in the sense that there is in Christianity and Islam. I mean, there's a character in the book of Job who's called the Satan, and that means the adversary, the one who speaks against you. But in Job's story, in the Hebrew Bible, there's no Satan who's opposed to God. That Satan in Job is part of the divine army. And he works for God. I mean, he obeys the commander-in-chief. He's just one of the servants who becomes, if you like, a devil's advocate, testing Job. Where you find those stories of Satan begin to develop and proliferate are about 2,000 years ago, when there are Jewish sects that are splitting off from others, like the Essenes. The Essenes are the people who collected and transcribed and preserved the Dead Sea Scrolls in the deserts, you know, of Israel. And they had left. This is a group of men, a group of particularly devout men, many of them were priests apparently, who had left their communities and in some cases their families to live in a community in the Dead Sea and swear an oath to a new covenant. They said most of Israel is now is corrupt because many Jews are cooperating with the occupation by the Roman Empire. And they're allowing this country to be dominated by Rome. So we want to have nothing to do with that. We're going to wait for the day when the Lord comes and avenges Israel and destroys all the evildoers. And we don't know if these people were planning jihad, whether they were planning a holy war against Rome. They might have been stockpiling weapons, or they might have been expecting an end of time. But they tell stories about the Satan, the Job, the Prince of Darkness, and they say, now Israel is split. Israel used to follow the Lord. Now Israel is divided, and some of us follow the Lord of Israel, but the majority has gone the way of the Prince of Darkness. So it comes out of split communities, and followers of Jesus were like that. They were a sect of Jews who said, well, most people in our communities have rejected our Messiah, but we know that we are the right ones, and they are not. So accusations would go back and forth between Jewish groups. It's a splitting of communities, because only Jewish men were holy enough to think of themselves as sons of God, and that's the same as the angels' names. So those stories come out of there, and it's those groups that proliferate them. And then when that group becomes separated from much of the Jewish community, you find stories of Satan are really dominant in the New Testament, and they're also dominant in Islam. And what they do is they condemn other groups. So it's a way of articulating harsh division between the good and evil groups. It's a good question. It took a while to figure something out about that.
Dr. Pagels, thank you so much for sharing so much of your story. And it leads me to wonder if you identify with a faith tradition now in your life, and if
with what? I'm sorry.
A faith tradition. And if yes, why or why not?
Yes, with a lot of them. Yes, I mean, I found when I came back from, when I had to move out of New York with the children because we couldn't afford to live there, and I was teaching at Princeton, and I couldn't possibly leave the children in New York as I did when my husband was there. I could leave for a day, you know, for part of the day, and he would be there. So we had to move to Princeton, and I thought I might go to the Quaker meeting, but in Princeton, I shouldn't say this, I hope nobody from there is here, they talk too much. There wasn't the silence. I've been to the meeting house here. Now, that's a very powerful place, and often they have been. But, and also, anyway, so that was the case. So I thought, well, okay, there's always the Episcopalians, you know, because I love the music, and the music is wonderful. So I would walk into this church where I often go now, and that music would start, and I would just start to weep. I just cried and cried. It was the only place I could cry, really. Didn't want to do that alone with the children. But I would go there, and the tears would flow because that music is so powerful, and it just opens you up. The whole liturgy is designed to open you up. I learned that with the Catholic masses at the monastery, which are totally simple. They're as simple as Quakers, the Trappists. So I love that. Can't help it. I don't know why. And I do a lot of yoga, and I have friends and, you know, meditate and whatever. But I also love the secret gospels because I find in these other texts stories and ways of imagining, I would say, that for me are often much more satisfactory than the traditional kinds of Christian story. I mean, I add them to it.
What do you think? How can the average ordinary individual or groups of individuals improve all the fighting that goes on between religions and has always gone on?
That's a huge question. I wish I could answer it. I mean, the work on the origin of Satan made me aware of how bitter that can be, because what I realized is that in the stories of Satan, see, I thought Satan would be in the stories, he'd be the outsider. He'd be, you know, he doesn't look like you, he's other. But that's not the case. The Satan in all these stories would be your brother who betrayed you. Or he'd be the commander-in-chief of the army who goes against the, you know, his commander. He'd be somebody who betrays you. But he's also intimate. He's also part of your group. And so it's people who are the closest together. You know, it's sometimes it's been Catholics and Protestants fighting wars, you know? Muslims and Christians and Buddhists fighting against other Buddhists or Hindus. I mean, you know, one thing I think about religious tradition that's a really huge hazard that we need to be aware of, you know, explosive devices, they really speak powerfully to the emotions. When I wrote the previous book, it was on the book of Revelation, because I wrote it out of frustration that political protest did nothing to stop George Bush from going in to make a war in Iraq. And all my work was in the Middle East and Egypt, and the Egyptians loved America, and I thought, how do you turn the entire Arab world against the United States? This is the way you do it. There's nothing more stupid than this. And you know, this country walked right into it. And it was propagandized with the book of Revelation. I found out that Donald Rumsfeld's office sent to George Bush, who you know was a Christian, an evangelical Christian, sent him every day intelligence briefings on the Iraq War with a picture and a quote from the Bible.
at one of the pictures was a picture of the gates of Baghdad, and with American tank going in with all the guns at the ready. And the quote was from Isaiah, "Let the righteous nation enter." Another one is shock and awe, because it comes straight out of the book of Revelation. That's why I wrote about the book of Revelation. It's shock to unbelievers, but it's awe to those who understand that the angel in the book of Revelation who pours God's wrath over Israel's ancient enemy, which is Babylon, that happens to be Baghdad. So American bombs were delivering God's wrath. And if you got the message, then you were probably in a group that understood that language. And if you didn't get the message, it's because you weren't supposed to. You weren't supposed to get the hidden messages. That's what I mean by highly explosive. So religious language is very powerful. It's been used in war over and over, and conflict, and it fuels conflict. What I realized, and I'm sorry I go on so long, but when I talk about the book of Revelation, I realize it's been used on both sides of every war in this country, for example. The Civil War, the American Revolution, the Civil War, it was used on the South against the North, and the North against the South, the Battle Hymn of the Republic is written straight out of that, coming of the end of time. It was used in World War I, and it was used in World War II by Goebbels, who was Hitler's propaganda minister, persuading people that Hitler was bringing in the thousand-year reign of Christ, the Dritte Reich, right? The Third Reich, the kingdom of Christ, and getting the world rid of human pollution, like people who didn't like Hitler, or homosexuals, or Jews, right? So I'm just saying, and it's used on the other side. If you know Messiaen's Quartet for the End of Time, it's a beautiful piece of music written by somebody in a Nazi prison camp singing praise to Jesus. It's a beautiful piece of work. And it was used in the Iraq War, and it's been used now. So I just think we need to know how powerful and explosive and deep the animosities fueled by religious passion can be. So I think you raise a very important issue. Mm. I wish there were a solution. I think we need to know that, though.
You referenced, Dr. Pagels, you made a reference earlier to the position of women, and I wondered if you could address, because of your scholarship, I'm making this too big, but the sexual politics of the Catholic Church.
that's big. And I don't know enough about it because I'm not in that communion. But, you know, I mean, the idea that women can't be equal to men in any way in that structure, right? It's very basic. And it's been true for many Protestant churches, too, until more recently. And it's been true in Jewish communities, except for the now certain Reform congregations will allow and others will allow women to be rabbis. So that's what I think the point of saying, yes, these are ancient ethical patterns and ancient social structures that can really be like straitjackets for people. That's why I say I'm not entirely a fan of religion. I think we have to, you know, try to see the many ways it affects people, even when we're not religious, because I know a lot of people who aren't, and yet those cultural values still play. In our legal codes, for example, the Equal Rights Amendment, you know, how recent is that?
I wanted to make a comment that the genesis of religion has nothing to do with God. The genesis of religion is the definition of the word religio, which means binding. And if we go back to ancient times, it was important to bind groups together to protect them from disease. It had nothing to do with God. Over the years, men created a god in order to keep their clan together and bind them in fear, to make sure that they didn't stray to another religion or to another group of people. So it was really for the protection of the group of people that were together to take care of them.
Yes, that's a very important aspect of it. To say it's without any idea of God, I can't think of an ancient tradition that
that doesn't have that, as a kind of sort of sense of a divine sanction in the universe. I mean, what you say is true about the language, but that word is coined quite a bit, you know, a few millennia after there were traditions and rituals and altars and sacrifices and people doing things like that. I mean, we could talk about the anthropology of it, but I've never gone into that.
It seems to me, in my experience, most people don't have a spiritual dimension to their lives. I think the, for instance, spectator sports fills a psychological space in many people's lives. Most churches have 300 or 400 people in them if they're lucky. And on any Sunday, you have 50,000 people watching an obscure college football game. I would challenge you to explain if spirituality really is relevant in contemporary Western society as opposed to, say, India or the Middle East.
Well, that's a good question. I don't think I ever said that everyone has or needs to have that kind of spiritual dimension. I know a lot of people who engage their sense of what their life is about in a very different way. My husband loved physics, and it was about the natural world. It wasn't about God. Some of my friends in Princeton, one is a theater director. For her, it's the life of the theater. And for artists, it's often poetry or music. For other people, it's caring for people. So there are many ways people engage their lives, and I don't think everyone needs to be religious myself. Many people that I know have nothing to do with that sort of tradition explicitly.
Thank you. Going back to what you were saying about Donald Rumsfeld and George Bush, I'm thinking about a place where I'm mystified in terms of the same political group of this country who claimed the moral high ground was the moral majority. And now there's a lot of things that look pretty immoral going on, and some people who you might think would have been appalled don't seem to be appalled. So I guess the question I have is, from your historical perspective, do you have any predictions of what will happen in this country with regard to sort of claiming religion and then abandoning it when it's not politically expedient?
You know, that's something I wish I knew more about, the way that the very interesting and complex divisions in American religious life. I don't know about that stuff because I haven't been working on it and thinking about it as a lot of my colleagues have. I mean, you're right, the moral majority claimed that, and there are a lot of, you know, Christian groups of all kinds who oppose each other and sometimes despise each other. I wish I could speak to that more adequately, but I have to leave that to people who know more about it. Thank you.
Please join me in thanking Dr. Elaine Pagels for being with us tonight.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.